From Montpelier, Vermont, this is Public Health Radio. On today's show, our guests are Howard Frumkin and Elliot Sklar, and we'll be looking at the relationship between transportation and urban planning and public health. Whether the issue is air pollution, traffic safety, or obesity, the approaches we take in designing our communities have a major impact on our health. We'll be looking at what these designs might look like, and we'll explore some of the obstacles that prevent the development of healthier neighborhood and urban environments. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. A report published in the November 12th issue of The Lancet found a vaccine against human papillomavirus to be 100% effective in providing protection against two strains of genital warts, the most common sexually transmitted disease. Human papillomavirus, also known as HPV, is the cause of the majority of cervical cancer cases worldwide. In the current study, 1,100 women were given three doses of the HPV vaccine, or a placebo, and followed for up to 27 months. While three doses of the vaccine provided 100% protection, a single dose afforded 95% protection. The article notes that this is the first time a vaccine is available that protects against cancer, since this vaccine has the ability to prevent about 70% of the cases of cervical cancer. The vaccine is expected to be available in Europe by the end of the year 2006. Availability in the U.S. has yet to be determined. Also on the vaccine front, a report in the journal Nature Medicine describes substantial success for the first time in a vaccine against tuberculosis. This would represent the first major advance in the prevention of TB in more than 80 years. Due to the very slow growth of the tuberculosis organism, trials of the vaccine will likely take 5 to 10 more years to be completed, but the initial findings have demonstrated the new vaccine to be safe and probably effective against TB, which takes the lives of 2 million people worldwide each year. More significantly, for the last few years, the disease has again been spreading, as many strains of tuberculosis have become resistant to available drugs used to treat the disease. The only available vaccine against TB, known as BCG, is so modest in its effect that most experts don't recommend its use. Experimental trials of the new TB vaccine showed both that it is safe and that it produced a significant boost in the number of infection-fighting T cells in the blood. Individuals who were given the new vaccine in addition to BCG generated over 10 times more T cells than those who received only the old vaccine. The Center for Science in the Public Interest, CSPI, has released a report criticizing the Bush administration for pressuring the World Health Organization to water down an anti-obesity initiative. Recognizing the growing worldwide epidemic of obesity and consequent chronic diseases such as heart trouble and diabetes, the World Health Organization began in May of 2002 to develop a set of recommendations to counter the trend. These recommendations include methods for altering consumer behavior, dietary patterns, and physical activity, as well as ways to address advertising, packaging, labeling, pricing, preparation methods, and other practices that affect nutrition and food consumption. Bruce Silverglade of the CSPI criticized the absence of a set of goals developed at the World Health Organization. These goals included limits on amounts of saturated fats, trans fatty acids, sugar and salt in processed food, and calls on companies to adhere to clear and consistent food labeling practices to help consumers make more healthy choices. Even more significant was the omission of a recommendation to prohibit advertising of junk food to children. The report is available at the World Health Organization website, who.int. The Center for Science in the Public Interest has developed a comprehensive set of recommendations for the prevention of childhood obesity, as well as a more detailed critique of the Bush administration policies on the issue. Their website is cspinet.org. Significant attention has been paid to the plight of the elderly, who often pay a great fraction of their incomes on prescription drugs. In a survey recently released by the U.S. Public Interest Research Group has highlighted the burden of drug prices on the 45 million Americans who have no form of health insurance. Health insurers and the Veterans Administration use their buying power to negotiate lower prices for the drugs they purchase for their beneficiaries. And the government of Canada negotiates lower drug prices on behalf of the entire Canadian population. But the 45 million uninsured in the U.S. have no one to negotiate on their behalf. And the U.S. PIRG survey documents the high cost of prescription drug prices the uninsured are forced to pay. The survey found that uninsured consumers in the Washington, D.C. area pay 89% more than the federal government for 12 common prescriptions, and that on average, uninsured consumers there pay more than twice as much for drugs purchased at their local pharmacy than they would pay if they purchased the same drugs from a Canadian pharmacy. The price differences range from 45% more for amlodipine, a drug commonly used to treat high blood pressure, to 530% more for Premarin, a hormone treatment millions of women use. The report is likely to increase popular pressure to permit drug reimportation from Canada and also to implement more significant moves to reduce prescription drug costs, some of which are outlined at the Public Interest Research Group's website, uspirg.org. On a related issue, the Boston Globe reported on a speech made at Harvard Medical School by the Canadian Minister of Health, Ujjal Dozan, last week. Dozan warned that the Canadian government might take action to end the sale of prescription drugs to U.S. residents in the event that the practice increases and causes a tremendous strain on Canada's drug supply. Though he noted that to date Canada has not experienced prescription drug shortages, an increase in medication sales to the U.S., which currently total about $600 million annually, could lead to shortages in the future. Dozan pointed out that a small country like Canada could not be expected to meet the prescription drug needs of approximately 280 million Americans without putting their own drug supply at risk, and that it's a matter of common sense that Canada could not be the drugstore for the United States. Coming up next, we'll explore the effects of urban design and transportation systems on public health. So stay tuned. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. When developers are designing new neighborhoods, and when public officials are crafting zoning regulations, health is rarely a major consideration in the plans they develop. Similarly, when metropolitan areas are planning transportation systems, the public health effects of their transportation plans are not a high priority area. But where a community sites a new school may affect how many children will be injured as pedestrians and how many families encourage their children to bicycle to school. Similarly, a decision to allow a fast food restaurant into the community may affect teenagers' eating habits. and the decision on whether bicycle paths or light rail systems will be built will likely have a great impact on commuter safety and how many community members will choose to buy and use a bicycle, and how many community members suffer from asthma attacks in the coming years. In September last year, a groundbreaking issue of the American Journal of Public Health appeared, which was exclusively devoted to the issue of how the urban and suburban community design affects public health. And on today's show, we are honored to have two of the editors of that issue with us to discuss the effect of built environment on public health. Howard Frumkin chairs the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at Emory University's School of Public Health in Atlanta. Dr. Frumkin was named to the EPA's Children's Health Protection Advisory Committee in 2001, where he chaired the Smart Growth Workgroup. He serves as a board member of the state of Georgia's Clean Air Campaign and on the Institute of Medicine's Roundtable on Environmental Health Science. He is author of a recently released book, Urban Sprawl and Public Health, available through Island Press. Our other guest is Elliot Sklar. He's the professor of urban planning and public affairs at Columbia University and a leading figure in the scholarly movement to reconnect the work of population health experts and urban planners in creating healthier cities. Professor Sklar has studied and written extensively on the economic, political, and social forces that drive actual metropolitan land use decisions. While much of his attention has been focused here in the United States, he was recently honored by his selection as coordinator of the United Nations Millennium Development Project Task Force, addressing the environmental, economic, and the health impacts of rapid urbanization in the poor countries of the global south. Howard Frumkin and Elliot Sklar, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
I wanted to congratulate both of you for your involvement in creating last September's issue of the American Journal of Public Health. I just want to say it's definitely the most interesting issue of the journal I've seen, bringing up issues that people in public health don't usually think about. And I guess I'm going to start off by reading the beginning of a piece that was contributed by Richard Jackson, who I'm sure both of you know. And I'm going to ask you both to give me your thoughts on what he starts out with here in his article. Here he goes. The drive from my office to my suburban Atlanta home is all too familiar. It begins with a scary 7-lane thoroughfare, infamous for its strip malls, lack of sidewalks, and high pedestrian fatality rates. Then it progresses to a jumble of interconnecting interstate highways packed with rush hour traffic, despite 12 or more lanes, and ends with clusters of new, low-density, single-family residential developments, lacking public parks, lacking playgrounds, libraries, lacking nearby stores and cafes, lacking sidewalks, lacking bicycle trails, and lacking public transit. Adults and children in my neighborhood travel by private automobile to virtually all of their destinations because they have no practical transportation alternatives. I guess I want to ask you both to comment on that. This is a scenario that is very familiar across the United States. And in some ways, I think many people would argue that it's the American dream for many people. So is there something wrong with that dream? And what are your feelings about what you just heard?
It's a pretty bleak description, isn't it? And you're right, it does sound familiar. I think that is the American dream for a lot of people. But a lot of the health information that's emerging now suggests that there are some downsides to that dream that we never counted on. When a lot of us began moving to suburban locations, we didn't realize that we'd lose the chance to walk and bike places. We didn't realize that we'd lose the opportunity to go to great places like cafes or sidewalk parks or gathering spots. We didn't realize that air pollution across the regions would get worse. So really, we're learning that there's an upside and a downside to that suburban dream. And that's making a lot of people in the health and planning professions rethink how to build great, healthy, wholesome places.
The argument is often made, well, it looks like this because this is what Americans have opted for. The problem is Americans can only opt from among what's available. And what's available is not just a question of their preferences creating a market. A number of political policy decisions were made to essentially subsidize massively automobile transportation and land use patterns that were consistent with that, and to do that at the price of mass transit and dense land use. In the United States right now, for example, federal subsidies run $7 for automobiles for every dollar for transit. And in a world like that, in which you get tax deductions for your property taxes and for the interest you pay on a mortgage, if you ride on roads that are massively subsidized, it's very difficult for viable options to appear, because we basically unequally subsidize one style of living over another.
Urban sprawl is dealt with throughout the issue that you've put together in the American Journal of Public Health. And I'm just going to start out with the article by Louis Dykstra. And that was a compilation of travel survey reports from transportation departments in about 12 developed countries. And it turns out that when people decide to go somewhere, anywhere in the United States, 93% of the time they're going to do it in a motor vehicle. While in Canada, there's an 86% chance it'll be in a vehicle. But in Europe, it's more like 60-40 or 50-50. And the amazing thing about his data is that it doesn't even change with age. You'd think that elderly people might be less likely to walk or bicycle, but they're not. They bicycle at old ages too. And I guess I would like to get a vision and get an understanding of how this relates to obesity and diabetes, and then what types of alternatives one could picture. What would a society that would encourage bicycling and especially walking, what would those societies look like? How would they be laid out?
Well, the obesity epidemic and all the diseases that follow from it, diabetes, arthritis, depression, and so on, it is a complicated phenomenon. Part of it, of course, has to do with aggressive mass marketing of junk food, of mega-sized portions, and so on. There's been a lot of discussion about that. But that's only part of the story. The other part of the story has to do with physical activity. After all, gaining weight is really a simple algebraic problem, more calories in than out. So if we eat more, that contributes to weight gain, and if we burn less, that contributes to weight gain. On the environmental side, on the issue of sprawl and transportation and so on, the set of questions that you're asking boils down to this. How does the environment that we create and live in contribute to physical activity, or how does it dissuade us from being physically active? And that's a complicated question, too. Certainly, if you don't provide people with opportunities to be physically active, then they won't be physically active. If there's no alternative for Dick Jackson in traveling from work to home except driving his car, if he doesn't have the option of walking or biking or even walking to the nearest transit station, then he's going to drive his car. But we have some evidence about kinds of community form get people to be more physically active. Good sidewalks, mixed land uses, which means that destinations like work and recreation schools and churches are near where people live. If destinations are close enough to make walking feasible, then people are more likely to walk. Safety matters a lot. Having people also out on the sidewalks to keep you company as you walk matters a lot. So we've learned enough about how to build communities that get people physically active that we probably are ready to start doing more and more of that. Do we know everything? No. Can we guarantee that if we build communities in certain ways, people are going to walk more? No. Clearly, we have to combine designing and building healthy communities with changing the way we all think, shifting that culture away from the car-dependent culture that you described to a culture where walking is more the norm as it is in Europe. You know, I'm speaking, as you know, from Atlanta, which is sprawl central. This is one of the showcases for sprawl nationally. And we see an interesting phenomenon here called the back from Europe phenomenon. People from Atlanta that are lucky enough to get to take a trip to Europe, go over there, they'll be in Italy or France or Germany, and they'll come back, and predictably, here's what they say. Boy, I had a great trip. It was beautiful over there. I ate like a pig, the food was delicious, and I lost weight. And I know why it was. It was because I walked every place, and boy, was that nice. What a walkable place that was. Why can't Atlanta be like that? Places that are well-designed and walkable are destinations. They're places that people love to go. They find them uplifting and restorative. We've got places like that in this country. We've got Annapolis and Georgetown. We've got parts of Manhattan. We've got Charleston and Savannah. Those are places that are beautiful to be. They're vacation destinations, but incidentally, they'd be illegal to build today because of the evolution of zoning and other regulations over the past century. The features of places like that include mixed use, putting different kinds of places near each other so that walking is feasible.
Can I just stop you and distinguish that from the other type of development?
You mean more typical suburban subdivisions?
Yeah.
Well, the pattern of suburban subdivisions is a low level of land use mix. That means that residential properties are kept in one place, separate from commercial properties, which are separate from schools. Schools notoriously these days are put on 20 or 30-acre parcels that are far away from anything, so that kids have to be bused or driven. Workplaces are far away from recreation and so on. The contrast is called land use mix, and that would be a traditional village. Parts of Burlington are like that, where you can go from the classroom to the workplace to the restaurant to the church to the library, all within relatively short distances. What goes hand in hand with that is the question of density. In traditional towns and cities, density is fairly high, and in conventional suburban subdivisions, density is pretty low. You might have a family of two or three or four people living on an acre or two or even 5 acres of land, whereas in traditional towns and cities, you can put 5 or 10 or 20 housing units on a single acre. Now, that sounds awfully dense, but in some of the beautiful European towns and cities that we talked about, in traditional American towns and cities, you have that level of density, and if it's well-designed and attractive, many people really like it.
I guess I'd like to turn now to the second sort of general disease category that Richard Jackson laid out, and that has to do with the implications on lung disease. The current Bush administration has changed elements in the Clean Air Act and relaxed regulations relating to the sources of pollution like utilities and factories. But another major source of air pollution has to do with vehicular use. What are your thoughts on exposure of everyone to nitrous oxide and ozone? Does the type of development decrease exposures?
Well, let's talk about two questions. The first is, where does air pollution come from? And the second is, what does it do to us? Where it comes from is it varies a little bit from place to place. Obviously, if you're in a sparsely populated area of the Southwest where there are smelters around, then most air pollution is going to be industrial in origin. But more and more, as we build metropolitan areas or even smaller towns that are heavily car-dependent, and as we ship goods from place to place by trucks, and as industry gets cleaner, it's turning out that the predominant contributor of air pollution is so-called mobile sources, cars and trucks. A third to a half of air pollutants nationally come from mobile sources, and that'll vary depending on which air pollutant we're talking about. But in general, a third to a half of air pollution comes from cars and trucks. If we drove less, we would create less air pollution, and the air would be cleaner and healthier to breathe. Now, what does it do to us? Well, asthma is a growing problem in the country. Almost 1 in 10 Americans has asthma now, and in some areas and in some populations, it gets up to 30 or 40% of people with asthma. We can't blame that on air pollution. Something is causing asthma to rise in our population. Nobody's exactly sure what it is. It's probably not air pollution because the asthma increase is taking place worldwide, even in places with clean air. But the important point is that we are a more and more vulnerable population in the sense that people that have asthma are susceptible to getting attacks triggered when they're exposed to air pollution. So it isn't necessarily that the pollution is causing asthma, but once a lot of people have asthma, they're going to have bad reactions to air pollution. Wheezing, coughing, shortness of breath, asthma attacks that lead to school absences and doctor's visits and emergency room visits and hospitalizations and so on. Here in Atlanta, it's a kind of a nice case study. You can do the same in Los Angeles, and in many places they're heavily trafficked. When traffic volumes go up, more and more people suffer respiratory symptoms, show up in emergency rooms, and so on. We had a nice opportunity to observe this during the Olympic Games here in Atlanta in 96. They told us all to stop driving, and they put lots of buses on the streets for the first and only time in recent history. Sure enough, people stopped driving, thinking that the traffic was going to be terrible. Traffic levels went down by about 25%. Ozone levels promptly went down by about 25%. And emergency room visits and doctor's visits for asthma among children went down by as much as 40%. The clear demonstration that if we drive and drive and drive, we pollute the air. And if we pollute the air, we make people sick with respect to respiratory health.
One of the other implications that this sprawl type of development has to do with injuries. And traditionally, people, maybe worldwide, certainly in the United States, don't use the word injury. They use the term accident. And I guess I would like to understand, several articles in this issue have pointed out that vehicular injuries, in some sense, are not accidents because the type of transportation plan that a city develops or a country develops, say that comparing the Netherlands, say, to the United States, that the type of planning has predictable effects on injuries to occupants of motor vehicles or pedestrians or bicyclists. And I'd like to hear you talk about that.
Well, I'm right in line with not using the word accident. I don't like to say accident because accident connotes randomness and unpredictability. Accidents are things that just happen. Injuries, on the other hand, are public health outcomes, just like cases of an illness, that occur for predictable reasons. And if we know what those reasons are and we intervene, we can prevent a lot of them. So let's talk about the injuries that are related to sprawl. If we build transportation systems, if we build places, communities, that require that we spend a lot of time driving on the road, and if we know that being on the road in a vehicle is a dangerous place to be, then all things being equal, we're going to have higher rates of injuries and fatalities. And that's exactly what happens. What we see is that in sprawling communities, people spend more of their time as drivers or passengers in cars, and the death rates from car crashes go up. The irony is that there's also an impact on pedestrians. We lose about 40,000, a little more than 40,000 Americans every year to motor vehicle crashes. We lose several thousand to pedestrian and bicycle incidents. But those numbers are going down. We're losing fewer and fewer pedestrians every year, and that's happening in many European countries as well. That's good from a public health point of view because we hate to see pedestrians and bicyclists killed, but it's a Pyrrhic victory. Because the reason that pedestrian death rates are coming down in this country is that people are simply walking less. In fact, a lot of parents won't let their kids walk to school or on errands because they perceive, with some justification, that it's dangerous to be out walking there in the streets. Now, why is that happening? Well, we're building streets that aren't safe for pedestrians at all. We build them for cars and not for people. We don't have good sidewalks. When we do have sidewalks at all, we often don't separate them by very much distance from the traffic. The crossings aren't good, and the drivers aren't accustomed to sharing the road with pedestrians, and so we don't have the driving culture of being considerate to pedestrians. One of the articles in the American Journal of Public Health issue that we're talking about points out happily that if you change the way you build places, if you have an infrastructure of good sidewalks, good crosswalks, good pedestrian protection. And if you have a lot of people out there walking and biking, then the pedestrian fatality rates actually go down. And that's the case in Germany and Holland, where the pedestrian fatality rates are much lower than in this country and are declining faster than they are in this country, even though many more people walk and bike. So it's an ironic situation. If nobody walks and bikes, and if we orient the entire community toward cars, then walking and biking become dangerous. But if more and more people walk and bike and we build accordingly, then walking and biking become much safer. Then we get the double benefits of the safety and also the healthy outcomes of walking and biking, the healthy outcomes of being physically active.
Now, the data from the Dykstra article in that issue, again, talking about transportation, were actually striking that in the Netherlands they do far more bicycling, probably 20 or 30 times more bicycling than we do, and they have designated bike paths in the whole country. But they point out that even though there's so much more bicycling in the Netherlands, and the average person in the United States who just decides, I'm going to go for a bike ride now, has a 6 times higher likelihood of being killed on that bike ride than a bicyclist in the Netherlands. And I think that's exactly what you're saying.
Right. The Netherlands has built an entire physical infrastructure to accommodate bicyclists. There are good paths, there are good trails, good crossings, and so on. And hand-in-hand with that, lots more people use their bikes. And that means that the drivers are a lot more aware of bicyclists, and so they learn to coexist much more safely than we do here.
The other problem in this country that we have is that there's a very strong prejudice against this public transportation, so that the average suburban parent who would think nothing of sending their 16-year-old out in a flimsy old used car will forbid them to set foot in the New York City subway system. And yet, if you were to look at death rates, even if you took homicide rates and compared them to the accident rates, the child is safer in the subway than they ever are on the highway, but suburban parents are afraid to send their children into public transportation systems. And we would begin to change that if more people would have the experience of using the public transportation system and they were safe and convenient for people. But those are the things that we underfund.
This conversation that we're having now brings to mind one of the articles that was in the American Journal of Public Health issued by Professor Lucy. He compared the risk of being the victim of a homicide in a city with the risk of dying in a car crash in the suburbs near the city. It's a fascinating comparison because a lot of people who leave cities to move to the suburbs do so for reasons of safety. They perceive that they'll be a lot safer from crimes like murder if they move out of the city to the suburbs. And it turns out that the risk that they take on of being killed in a car crash far outweighs the risk of being killed by a homicide if they had stayed in the city. It's one of these examples of how we may prefer suburban lifestyles for what seem like very good reasons, but we forget that there are costs as well.
People in public health have traditionally defined negative places, hazardous waste sites or houses that have a lot of carbon monoxide, or generally things that make a place unsafe, no fire alarm system or whatever. But in your article, Howard Frumkin, you pointed out that maybe we should also be thinking about what a positive place is. And I guess I'd like you to develop that idea a bit.
Well, I think all of us know at an intuitive level that there are good places that restore us and uplift us and make us feel better. Every religion has a tradition of sacred places, whether it's a mountain for Hindus or whether it's a cathedral for Catholics. Those are places that are uplifting. People that choose to go on vacations go to beautiful places like spas and resorts. And part of it is getting a break from the usual routine, of course, but the beauty and design of those places contributes to feeling good. That's something we haven't really focused on very much at all. So if we think about our community designs, how can we build communities that offer us good places, the kinds of things that make us feel good, help us dissipate stress and enjoy each other's company and function better? We know some of the answers. Contact with nature. That doesn't have to mean thousands of acres of wilderness. That can mean a well-designed park, a peaceful, tranquil place.
Well, I want to stop you there just for a second. People have wanted to be in suburbs partly because then they could have a big backyard and that's their green space or whatever.
Right.
But I think what I think the kinds of development you're talking about and you're calling a positive space, a sense of a positive place, is where you might have vastly, if you look at the community as a whole, you might have vastly more concentrated, many more people living in a concentrated way, but then there is a beautiful park available for them. that's beautifully laid out, and it's much, much, much nicer than anybody's backyard even comes close to being. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's exactly what you're hearing. One of the ironies of our impulse to go to the suburbs is that lots of people do it because they want that little bit of nature, that little bit of green space. And they may get a very nice little half acre of green space, but that comes at a cost, because when we all do it, we use up big tracts of green space, and there aren't large areas that we can easily get to. In fact, the standard pattern of building suburban subdivisions, unlike older cities of a couple of centuries ago, it overlooks the need for parks and public spaces. A developer is going to build a residential subdivision is liable to buy the parcel, put down the roads and the homes, and not put down any parkland or any preserved green space. So we get our little piece of green space in our backyard, but we lose opportunities for preserving large tracts of nature where we can go easily and get away.
The other thing that we do that I've been following the trends on recently in suburban house design is that we've basically been having this loss of a sense of community and more of a kind of a privatization of private life, that in a very frightening world, what people end up doing is they try to build more and more of what should be socially shared goods into their homes, so that more and more people will want a swimming pool of their own. They'll want their own gym for game rooms, entertainment centers that are focused on the TV, and of course, very good systems of burglar alarm. If people are closing down and pulling up the moat, that can't be good for mental health.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guests today are Howard Frumkin and Elliot Sklar, both experts on the effects of urban planning and transportation systems on public health. In the second part of today's show, we'll be exploring some of the obstacles to the creation of healthier urban environments. So stay with us. Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guests today are Howard Frumkin and Elliot Sklar, both experts on the impact of our built environment on public health. During the first part of today's show, we looked at the various features of our transportation system and urban plan that impact several dimensions of health, including injuries, respiratory problems, psychological health, traffic deaths, and cardiovascular health. During the upcoming part of our interview, we'll look at some of the fiscal and political obstacles that need to be overcome in order to create an environment that fosters public health. Now back to the interview. Back when President Bush, candidate Bush at that time, was running for office, we had a budget surplus. Just for a few years, we're beginning to pay down our large national debt. And candidate Bush at that time very specifically said, individuals can spend money better than government can spend money, and therefore any excess government money should leave government and go back to individuals because, again, they can spend that money better. But when I was thinking about almost everything we were discussing on today's show, zoning issues, designing transportation systems or urban design, these are an almost inherently collective decision. Even a wealthy person can't create an urban design or even a 50-mile-long bicycle path. So I guess I'd like you to address the issue of philosophy, that how do you view these as community or communitarian types of issues?
Well, you raise a great question. You have to believe in your heart that there is a public realm, that there are things that we do better together than we can do separately. And lots of the infrastructure changes that we've been talking about that promote public health fit exactly in that category. New York City could never have built Central Park when it did in the 19th century as the result of individual efforts. That was a collective effort that the city government was persuaded to undertake. You can't build transit systems through individual effort. Those are collective efforts. So really, this is at the heart of public health. Public health represents collective efforts to create the conditions in which people can make healthy choices and live healthy lives. And very much in that spirit, if we undertake public expenditures to create the kinds of places that make people healthy, that's the road to success.
There's two pieces to it. One had to do with addressing an ideology that's popular in certain quarters, that Jeffersonian notion, the government that governs least governs best, and the government that doesn't exist is probably the best government. But the problem is the world doesn't work that way. And it's not that they're not willing to spend money. It's not that they're not willing to run deficits. It has to do with what they value and what they don't value. So it's really not in some very functional sense, an argument about government. But what we don't have going right now is a dialogue about the sense that we're all Americans, that we share a community, that we share a set of interests. Instead, we're told that we're all individuals and we have to come up with individual solutions. That's why I talked about house designs that are being built around the notion that every family is an island unto itself. You don't need community recreation centers. You don't need to have a town swimming pool. The problem is that as we try to pursue individual solutions to the wrenching problems of the world, we only make them worse. And I think we can talk to people about that.
Well, the irony here is that we are making public expenditures that shape the places where we live, work, and play, but we don't realize that much of the time. So, for instance, if a developer decides to buy a huge parcel of land in the exurban edge and build a residential development there, the developer expects, correctly, that public funds at the end of the day will pay for the sewage lines, the electric lines, the roads, and all the other infrastructure that he needs to make that development feasible. We have an enormous raft of public policies that encourage sprawl by putting public funds into the infrastructure that supports sprawl. We could make a decision if we collectively decided to put money into infrastructure like parks and bicycle paths and mass transit and so on. It might not involve a major increase in public expenditures, but it would involve changes in our priorities.
The other issue that I see as a big obstacle to implementing these kinds of changes are fiscal, more practical issues. Is the money available? After candidate Bush was elected to the presidency, the tax cuts were enacted, and that decreased available government revenue to implement any system-wide change in transportation systems. And then the recession contributed to that, and then the wars further is siphoning available funds away from transforming our transportation system or our urban environment. That now we have a fiscal crisis where the federal government's got a huge deficit, supposed to continue as far as we can see into the future. And really, state and local governments really have quite significant deficits or budget issues as well. Or who would have thought they'd be cutting firefighters and police officers after what happened at 9/11? How do you get the kinds of changes we've discussed on today's show to be affordable to various levels of government?
Well, the first answer is that lots of the changes that we've been talking about don't cost very much money. If you change your zoning practices so that you encourage mixed-use development, mixed-use use of land, putting stores and schools and so on near where people live, that's budget neutral. There are some costs that are expensive, like putting in mass transit systems, but that's a different story. I'll come to that in just a second. An important message is that lots of the conditions that would encourage healthy places are budget neutral. Second, when things cost money, very often that's not public funds, but that's private funds. So let's imagine that a developer is putting in a residential development. If the ordinances locally require that there be sidewalks leading to stores and other community assets placed in the residential community, then the developer has the responsibility of putting in those sidewalks. Now, that either means that the lots will be a little bit smaller because some land was dedicated to sidewalks, or that the lots will stay big, but there will be fewer lots there. Either the developer pays or the homeowners pay. Either way, those are small incremental costs, and they're private costs, not public costs. So we don't need to turn to government to fund those kinds of things. Finally, the very big infrastructure investments like mass transit are public costs. But as we said a minute ago, we already are making large public investments in some of the conditions that lead to sprawl, such as highways. In fact, the biggest expenditure in this whole arena is probably the federal transportation bill, which we pass every 5 or 6 years. If we simply reallocated money rather than spending more money, if we put a little bit more into transit and a little bit less into highways, that too can be budget neutral. So I think there are lots of very practical ways in which we can affect changes that make healthy places, either budget neutral changes or costly changes that we could pay for by transferring funds from one thing to another.
If you build a park, yes, you lose the potential to use that land for taxable purposes. On the other hand, we also know that houses located around parks go up significantly in value. And you get, in other words, the good that's created to some extent can get recaptured in some taxes, but to some extent it gets recaptured in the vitality of that city or town, the attractiveness of it for businesses to locate there. And nobody is doing those broader calculations. And part of what we have to do, it seems to me, is we have to be the social cost accountants. We have to basically help people understand what the social costs are and what the benefits are. And understand that this is a very expensive lifestyle that we live right now, and that we could, in fact, live better for less if we change some of these patterns.
When these expenditures are being discussed, for example, choosing among different potential transportation investments, those would be expensive decisions. Is the public health point of view ever represented? Does that actually happen? In other words, if you implement a transportation that emphasizes public transit as opposed to automobiles and sprawl roadways that sprawl out in long distances, as we pointed out earlier today, you're going to save really many lives in not at first due to transportation safety. And I guess, are the costs of to the public health treating those people in hospital and really over many years, are those costs ever factored in?
Sometimes they are, not enough in my view, but you won't be surprised to hear that since I wave the public health flag constantly. For example, there's a nonprofit group in Washington called the Surface Transportation Policy Project. It's a group that advocates for more transportation choices, moving away from simply an automobile-oriented transportation system. That group has been very good about publicizing the health implications of different transportation policies, pointing out that there are health benefits to be gained from bicycles and walking and transit as opposed to a pure automobile orientation. So at the federal level, that certainly is part of the debate. It's a part that we need to make more vigorously, in my view. At the local level, I just came from a meeting this morning here in Atlanta where we're facing cutbacks in our public transportation system. And one of the kinds of information that we talked about developing is projections of what will be the health costs if transit service is cut way back. Of course, the health costs will involve more air pollution because people who currently take transit will have to drive, and more car crashes, because if you put more cars on the road, you're going to see more car crashes. So we'll be generating that kind of information and feeding that into our local public debate about transit cutbacks. I think that's a nice example of how we can factor that into the decision-making.
I assume that the methodologies of implementing these kinds of changes would be much simpler in a community yet to be developed. Many areas in the United States are expanding, not merely Las Vegas, that's in Phoenix, those are notorious, but many areas in the country are still expanding, and presumably they could get it right the first time and build a healthy community without potentially any extra expense at all. But I guess I'd want to ask you about that, and then also about what resources are available to help guide communities, whether they're new or they want to work on an existing community to make it healthier. What kinds of resources can be made available to assist?
Well, you made the interesting point that it might be financially feasible to do it right the first time, and I agree. But, you know, there are tremendous economic opportunities in the places that have been built for a long time that simply need to be revived. We did it right the first time. If you look at the pre-automobile cities, the grid-like small towns and urban neighborhoods that survived from the 19th century, lots of those look very much like smart growth neighborhoods. You've got grid-like streets with a high level of connectivity. You've got mixed land uses where people can live near where they work and play. You've got transit systems that are in place. You've got paths where people can walk and bike. So a lot of that's in place. In fact, there's an enormous efficiency to be had in redeveloping neighborhoods that have infrastructure in place already, the electric lines, the water lines, and so on, rather than building brand new developments on green fields. There's a great economic opportunity there. Where do we get the funds to do that? Well, we've got a growing population. The population is expected nearly to double by the end of this century, according to the census, so we have to put people somewhere. We've got a growing economy, and all of the people that are represented in the growing population are contributing money to the growing economy, and all of them have to buy housing. So, I don't think we need to be talking about relying on public funding to do the things we're talking about. I think that, naturally, if people buy housing, and if people face options on the housing market, if people can buy in smart growth neighborhoods where they can walk more, they'll do that. People will vote with their pocketbooks.
As you point out, you're not going to undo a built environment that you've built over the last 50 or 100 years. But what you can begin to do is you can begin to shift it by building commuter rail lines, by how you begin to use your zoning to encourage density in certain places, to discourage sprawl in other places. You have to begin to do that. You have to also tackle the fiscal issue, how taxes are collected and where money is spent, because a lot of decisions about location become decisions about tax incentives, border wars between cities and towns next to each other, between neighboring states, and those all begin to distort the ability to begin to develop denser and more vibrant mixed-use communities in these metropolitan regions. So these are the things that we have to do. And the federal government has to take a very important leadership role in this happening, so that we have, you know, under the Clean Air Act, we have regulations about where air quality is supposed to be. The simple fact is that for the state of Connecticut to be in compliance on ozone, it could almost take all its cars off the road and not be in compliance because the ozone drifts up from New York in the afternoons. And so these kinds of problems are going to take a wise federal leadership. It's going to take a lot of encouragement to metropolitan regional development. That's where the bulk of Americans live. And then it's going to take fiscal and land use policies within these regions to begin to change that. But all of that is within our ability to do. What we can do politically at this point is another matter. What we're capable of is much greater.
One of the most important things in getting to healthy communities is having a vision of how things can be. I think too many of us who grew up in conventional suburban developments and who are a little bit numbed to the view of strip malls on wide highways, we forget that there can be places that are attractive and walkable and dense and functional all at the same time. I show people a lot when I'm teaching this material. I show pictures of the transformation of places from strip malls to almost European-looking neighborhoods. People need to envision the idea that they could walk or bike to work, something that's been standard for centuries, but it's almost unimaginable for a lot of us now. So I think envisioning change is a necessary first step. Next, we need to be talking among ourselves across disciplines. We need to get the planners and the architects and the landscape architects to be talking with the doctors and nurses and public health people, because we really do have a common set of interests. We've become so specialized over the last century that we forget that we have those common interests. But I dream of a day when doctors and public health people are actively talking about land use and transportation decisions, because they understand that those are important determinants of health. And then last, we need to make the business case for healthy places. There are so many benefits to be gained by building healthy places. This is like a medication that treats half a dozen diseases. It's a medication that we would love if we had it. A medication that cuts down car crashes and improves cardiovascular health and improves respiratory health and improves physical fitness would be a terrific triumph. By the same token, if we build neighborhoods in ways that get people walking more, driving less, and all the other benefits we've talked about, we're going to see a lot of gains from that, both in health terms and in economic terms. That comprises a strong business case for smart growth.
Howard Frumkin and Elliot Sklar, I'd like to thank you so much for joining us on Public Health Radio.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Thank you very much. It was an honor to be here with you, Marvin.
Several websites provide useful information on the road to urban and transportation plans that foster public health. First is the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, cdc.gov. Click onto the environmental health section of the website, which lays out some of the health impacts of the built environment. Smart Growth America is a coalition of groups which advocate for health-promoting growth that supports the local economies yet protects the environment. The website is smartgrowthamerica.com. Finally, the Surface Transportation Policy Project helps translate the issues addressed on today's show into the arena of legislation and policy. That website is stpp.org. Well, that's it for today's show. If you want to give us some feedback, or if you missed part of today's show and want to hear it, or want to tune into any of our previous shows, check out our website, publichealthradio.org. That's one word, publichealthradio.org. Thanks for listening, and join us again next month for another airing of Public Health Radio.